This is That History Podcast.
We have a threefold primary responsibility. Number one, get people saved. Number two, get them baptized. Number three, get them registered to vote.
Well, thank you for that, Jerry Falwell. Much appreciated. Those, of course, are the words of the evangelical pastor Jerry Falwell, the founder of the Moral Majority, and somebody we're going to hear from later in this episode. But to start it off, welcome back. This is episode 2 on That History Podcast. You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and anywhere you get your podcasts. I am Pete Stamm, a.k.a. That History Teacher, on all those same social platforms. And we're in the middle of our three-part series about Christian nationalism. And we're learning about where the movement came from, which was, of course, built in the 1960s with a little bit of history before that. And now we're looking at the 1970s and 80s, mostly through the presidencies of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, and the rise of some very famous pastors who helped to steer evangelicals even further into the clutches of conservatives. But first, of course, we go back to a little context. And of course, this context has to go back to the beginning of our nation. We talked in the last episode about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, specifically the Free Exercise and Establishment Clauses of the First Amendment of the Constitution, which stated that Congress shall make no law requiring any practice of a religion. There will be no religious test, as we see in Article 5, for people taking an oath of office. However, there is one more document to look at if you want to see where we get this idea that America is not a Christian nation. So, despite what Mr. Falwell decided to give us there in the beginning with the idea of saving, baptizing, and registering people to vote, this was never a goal of the United States. And it actually goes back to one of our first treaties that we signed on November 4th of 1796 with the nation of Tripoli, of course, now modern-day Libya. Now, a little bit of context on this situation. One of our first big foreign crises, situation where we needed to step in and protect our foreign interests, was in the Mediterranean Sea, dealing with the Barbary pirates who were raiding quite a few ships, many European ships, anybody trading and sailing through the Mediterranean. And of course, America is trying to build up a trade relationship of its own with Britain, even though we just fought them in a war, with France, with the Dutch, all these nations who we either fought against or helped us fight against the British in the Revolutionary War. And of course, our ships are being taken over by pirates. We're losing many different goods and things we're trying to trade with the Europeans. We're losing goods we're bringing back. International trade is coming to a halt because of these pirates. Many nations had already settled on what amounted to bribes to pay off these pirates to allow them to still sail through and not be bothered. John Adams, however, president at the time, saw things quite differently. And he did not want to pay anybody or bribe anybody. And this, of course, goes back to the XYZ affair as well, where France was trying to get bribes out of America to protect its interests throughout and to gain its support as Napoleon was starting to take power eventually, the French Revolution ongoing. They're trying to figure out how to best use America after helping America to defeat the British. So as much as George Washington may have warned us about foreign entanglements and not getting involved, here we are, not even before his own death, just after his resignation, I suppose, or stepping down as president, jumping into foreign entanglements, signing treaties, but in a way to protect our interests. And so John Adams sends, obviously, some diplomats, representatives, and they go and discuss the basis of a treaty with Tripoli. And so it's the Treaty of Peace and Friendship between the United States of America and the Bey and subjects of Tripoli of Barbary. And while this is just a bunch of articles that seem to settle the idea of any sort of conflict or war with Tripoli, with Barbary pirates, protecting economic interests, I need to turn your attention to Article 11 of the treaty, which seems to come out of nowhere because it doesn't really have much to do with any sort of economic issue or even mostly a political issue. It actually focuses on religion. And so Article 11 states, I'll read it to you, and then we'll discuss it for a couple of minutes. As the government of the United States of America is not, in any sense, founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslimmen, and as the said states never have entered into any war or active hostility against any Mahomian nation, it is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinions shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries. Now, besides an obvious pun, I'm not sure about any Mahomian nations, especially after the last Super Bowl, where the entire country seemed to revolt against Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. Sorry, couldn't resist a little political sports joke humor there. Article 11 clearly states the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. Stop, period, full stop, end of story. Why would this be included in the treaty itself, where it seems to not have anything to do with ships, vessels, navies, economies? Well, it was important for the United States to show that we were not a government based with faith, with an official religion, and that we had no problems with other religions. Many of the people involved in this treaty were either in the room or involved in negotiations or party to the negotiations of the Constitutional Convention. And again, these founders are not Christian necessarily. They may be deists. They may believe in something. They may be agnostic. They may have had an idea of a creator. After all, for Jefferson to quote in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal and their rights endowed by their creator of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it just shows that they thought something was there. They weren't sure what. It might have been a Christian God. It might not have been. You hear references by many of these founders to the idea of providence or to the idea of the Almighty, but not necessarily referring to a Christian God. So for the United States to make sure to not only point out that it is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, and that it has no issue with the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslimmen, which basically refers to Tripoli and Barbary being a nation of Muslims following the religion of Islam. Both Christianity and Islam are Abrahamic faiths, so they share common ancestry, but of course they have diverged quite a bit over the past about 1,500 years or so. It was very important to make sure that people were aware this is not a religious fight. You know, England, of course, has the Church of England as its official religion. France had its own fighting between Catholic and Protestant French for years. If you go back even to people such as Joan of Arc leading fights to hold on to land against the English, being seen as a Catholic versus Protestant fight, the Protestant Reformation was about 200 to 300 years before this, many different faiths seemed to take charge and be intertwined with government in Europe at the time. The American founders honestly thought this is not good. We can't have this really be a part of our nation and dictate what we want. So they decided to make it very, very clear that America was not a Christian nation. It was not founded as a Christian nation. It was not founded upon Christian principles. It was not at all a Christian nation. But of course, as I discussed in the last episode, that didn't stop people from going backwards in history and assigning Christian values or finding commonalities and similarities between Christian values and the Enlightenment values and other things to sort of impart their faith on American politics. But of course, the inclusion of that article begs the question, why have it there in the first place? Again, why would this be necessary? The historian Mark Knoll actually went back and looked at evangelicalism through the American Revolution and found something quite interesting. He actually was able to categorize a few of the founders as very evangelical, including Samuel Adams, John Jay, Patrick Henry, Roger Sherman, who were basically evangelicals, maybe by a different name, but that others such as George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Madison, John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, and Benjamin Franklin were not. And so he actually goes ahead and promotes this idea that while the founders leaned in a generally Christian direction, it really wasn't an evangelical or a Christian movement at all. So while you could see evidence of Christianity within the documents, the fact that the people who actually wrote these documents, not just the ones who were in the room when it happens, to quote a play about a certain founder, the ones that mattered, the ones that became presidents, the ones that were in charge of the nation, the ones that were executives or were big-time power brokers during that day, they were not Christian. And I think, ironically, Noel goes on, again, being a great historian, especially a Christian historian, shows how the idea of British culture and American culture deriving from that actually lends to somewhat of a Christian society because of the denomination of Christianity that many of these colonists were. In certain ways, the way that faith had become intertwined with British politics, especially through Henry VIII and breaking away from the Catholic Church and forming the Church of England and having the monarch be the head of the church, that certainly put a lot of faith and a lot of Christian faith directly into the British government. And of course, with this taking place around the same time as the Protestant Reformation, there have been multiple generations throughout British history that have subscribed to the idea of a faith-based monarchy and a faith-based government. So while the earliest English settlers may have reached the colonies within 100 years of Henry VIII, many more were still coming over and still migrating across the Atlantic Ocean way through the late 16 and early 1700s that would have had an influence on American policy and politics as well. And of course, what Noel does a great job of is transitioning from the revolutionary period and the signing of some of these documents, which include the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and the aforementioned Treaty of Friendship with Tripoli, to the era that we know as the Second Great Awakening. But of course, during the same time of the Revolution, there was a First Great Awakening. So that's where we're going to transition now into some of the preachers from those eras and see how Christianity inserted itself into politics. And from there, we can transition back to the 1970s and 80s and see how two influential Christian pastors, Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell, began to exert their influence on American politics much in the same way. And so we move into the First Great Awakening. You know, we were talking about a period in the 1780s, 1790s, and of course going back to the Constitution. The Great Awakening, the first one, took place between 1730 and 1745. So we're still looking at a colonial America, but it's greatly influenced by one specific region of the American colonies, and that would be New England. New England's history, of course, goes back to 1621 with the landing of the Pilgrims at Plymouth Rock, as the story sort of goes, right? And of course, the tradition holds that the first Thanksgiving dinner was held with the natives who were there. All of these things we learn as children. Of course, as we move on through our lives, we start to learn what is fact and what is fiction in these stories. But generally, we're going to go along with that premise here just to make it a little easier for the context for those who are a little newer to the history of our country. The pilgrims that came here were not of the Church of England. They are clearly of a more, Puritan mold. They were, in fact, called the Puritans. They did not follow the Church of England. And at this time, you were being persecuted in England if you did not follow the Church of England. And so they originally moved from England to the Netherlands, to Holland, but they did not find that they lived well among the Dutch. And so upon returning to England, they decided to leave for the new colonies. They thought they would do very well in a new place called Virginia. Let's not forget, of course, that Virginia did not get off to a great start with, of course, the colony of Roanoke and the Jamestown Starving Time. But that's besides the point. These pilgrims, these Puritans, these separatists almost, if you will, wanted to break away and find a place to practice religious freedom. Of course, again, how the story goes. They wanted the freedom to practice their own religion and to make people practice their religion as well. And as the historian Robert Rossell notes in his article in the American Journal of Sociology from 1970, it was more of a Calvinist work ethic. So the idea of Calvinism, that there's like predestination, but there's also hard work to be done. This is this brand of Christianity that these Puritans are bringing to America. And because they are the more religious area at this time, I would suppose, due to them being the first real Christians to come over and practice their faith, their own brand of faith, to try to sort of evangelize in their own way. It's their preachers, it's their branch of Christianity that has a great influence on the country and starts to inspire many people to return closer to God, to return closer to their Creator, to work in the fields, to sacrifice everything in the name of God, to make sure that they were doing what was right, to achieve providence and the promised land. And interestingly enough, Rossell's main conclusion, as it comes to political and religious context, seems to show that these people are losing grip on power in society. There are many new denominations of Christianity popping up. There are many new faiths and ideas, including deism as one of them, as we've mentioned before with some of the founding fathers. And so the Great Awakening ends up becoming not just a way to bring religiosity back to America, but to also keep some political power, some political clout in the hands of Calvinists and even Congregationalists, who Rossell notes are the largest branch or denomination of Christians that we find in especially New England at this time. And so in a way, they're trying to show their worth to God, show that they are the chosen people, you know, much in the same way that the Hebrews and the Jewish people in the Old Testament and early New Testament tried to show they were the chosen ones as well. And so there's sort of a callback to early Judaism and probably early Christianity as well in terms of who was chosen by Jesus specifically, according to tradition, that being Jesus of Nazareth. And so when we look at the Great Awakening in this political context, it is a push for power. Right? So there's been a push for power, for Christian power in America early on. It doesn't really hit the status of a Christian nationalism that we see from the 60s on, but it's definitely another one of these seeds planted that begins to cultivate throughout the entirety of American history. And so in colonial times, two of the major preachers in the first Great Awakening would have been Jonathan Edwards and George Whitehead. George Whitehead being a British-born preacher who moved to New England and toured through in the 1740s and late 1730s. And Jonathan Edwards, a New England preacher, New England native as well, who was also still preaching around these times. While both had captive audiences when they preached, their content was a little different. And this is a great way to see how different preachers could have different influence on different parts of American society and culture, because they would generally have similar audiences. You know, we don't have statistics on who attended each event as we do for future preachers such as Billy Graham, but we know that many of the people attending these sermons were God-fearing Christians who wanted to hear something that would help them return closer to God and also glorify the work they were doing in their colony. So we're going to start with Jonathan Edwards, who on July 8, 1741, gave a sermon entitled Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And of course, this is a trope that a lot of preachers use even still to this day. God being angry with us, God being angry with his followers, with his people. Why have you not done what I've asked you to do? You haven't converted to me. And of course, in a way, this can also tie into Goldwater in the future, using fear as a tactic, fear as a narrative, fear as something powerful to get people to the cause you're asking them to join. And what better way to instill fear in people, especially in a religion, than by talking about damning a certain group of people to hell, or saying that if you are a sinner, you are going to hell. In this specific sermon, Edwards has a fascinating section where he goes to talk about people who are non-believers, people who don't specifically believe in what the Christian God is saying, people who don't follow the Christian God's doctrine. And so this section, among many others, talks about hell, damning. But listen to the full text of this section. And there are some biblical scripture quotes, and I will let you know what chapter and verse they are, so you can go and reflect on them. You can feel free to pause the podcast for a second if you'd like and read that chapter and verse just to see what he's referring to. Most of these people in the audience would have known these verses already or pretended to have known them or purported to have known them through different Bible studies or reading on their own or hearing other pastors speak about it. But if you need a moment, please feel free when you hear me quote the chapter and verse. Go ahead and pause it, read it yourself so you can sort of see what's being quoted or see the full context of the quote, because he does use pieces of different scripture. So Edwards in 1741 told his flock, or his crowd, if you will, they are already under a sentence of condemnation to hell. They being non-believers, non-Christians, of course, and probably members of different Christian denominations and sects who are not of his persuasive or pervasive part of his faith. So they are already under a sentence of condemnation to hell. They do not only justly deserve to be cast down thither, but the sentence of the law of God, that eternal and immutable rule of righteousness that God has fixed between him and mankind, is gone out against them and stands against them, so that they are bound over already to hell. He that believeth not is condemned already. That is from John chapter 3, verse 18. So that every unconverted man properly belongs to hell. That is his place. From thence he is, ye are from beneath, and thither he is bound. It is the place that justice and God's word and the sentence of his unchangeable law assign to him. And that last part is also from John, but from chapter 8, verse 23. Congratulations, if you are not a Christian and you do not believe in God, you are going to hell. This is exactly what Jonathan Edwards tells his followers. Now, of course, the hope here is that these people listening to him are already Christians. They are already followers. They are doing what is right. But it's a warning. It's a warning from him to those who are not, to those who are sitting there with maybe a guilty conscience in his eye or in their own eyes, that if you're not doing the will of God, you have not converted fully, and you're not doing what God has asked you to do, you are going straight to hell. I pause for emphasis to let that sink in, because it really does go back to a message that we heard in the last episode. It goes back to people, again, using not only fear, but also that your future is bleak. You have no future if you are going to ignore what your religion is telling you to do. This was a common theme throughout the First Great Awakening. People needed to come back to Jesus. You still hear people today saying, come back to Jesus. Even Super Bowl ads, you know, Jesus saves, Jesus listens, he is Jesus, he is yours, he is. He's there for you. Come back to Jesus, come back to the church. You hear these messages quite a bit in pop culture today, through advertising today. But these messages have been true since the dawn of Christianity as a religion, and especially in America since the First Great Awakening. While he doesn't use the same language, George Whitehead has a very similar message in a gospel sermon based on the Gospel of Matthew. And of course, the quote from him is from chapter 8, verse 22 in the Gospel of Matthew, which says, "Let the dead bury their dead." And in this undated sermon titled "Worldly Business, No Plea for the Neglect of Religion," Whitehead's going to give a very similar theme, but in a little bit nicer language. He talks about these words of Christ himself, Jesus of Nazareth, right? Let the dead bury their dead, but tries to explain them in a more relatable way and also show the figurative way that Jesus of Nazareth is said to have spoken. For instance, you know, the famous Eye of the Needle. Is it really about a camel passing through the Eye of the Needle? Or was it the path to get into Jerusalem with a lot of stuff stacked up on your camel as you had to move stuff over, sort of like a low bridge, getting a tractor trailer under a very low bridge today? This is, of course, the debate among many biblical scholars. What is fact? What is truth? What is figurative or literal language as used by Jesus of Nazareth? And so Whitehead makes the point that this is probably more figurative language, because as he states in his sermon, as he, Jesus of Nazareth, was conversing with those that were gathered round about him, he gave one of them an immediate summons to follow him. But he, either afraid to go after such a persecuted master, or rather loving this present world, says, "Suffer me first to go home and bury my father." Or as most explain it, "Let me first go and dispatch some important business I have now in hand." But Jesus said unto him, "Let the dead bury their dead. Leave worldly business to worldly men. Let thy secular business be left undone, rather than thou shouldst neglect to follow me." Now, whether this person did as he was commanded, I know not. But this I know, that what Christ said here is person. He has often whispered with the small still voice of his Holy Spirit, and has said to many here present, that rise up early, and late take rest, and eat the bread of carefulness. Come draw off your affections from the things of this life. Take up your cross and follow me. But they, willing to justify themselves, make answer, Lord, suffer us first to bury our fathers, or dispatch our secular affairs. I say unto all such, let the dead bury their dead. Let your worldly business be left undone, rather than you should neglect to follow him. What else is Whitehead talking about here but dropping everything and following Christ? Which I think is fascinating because, yes, it lets people understand that they must do what the Lord is asking them to do in Christianity. What it's also doing is reminding them that being a Christian and following God comes first. Worldly business must be neglected. And as a historian, especially looking at political history, I can't sit here but think, what is more worldly than politics? How is injecting Christianity into politics going to allow somebody to leave those worldly desires behind, to neglect the worldly business and do what Christ asks us to do? So interpreting that text in that way shows you that there are shifts in how Christianity can be interpreted, right? Yes, when you go back to someone like Whitehead, yes, he's trying to talk about saving the souls, right? But also by saying you have to leave the worldly business behind, you have to forget the politics. You have to forget even, you know, some of the debts you owe here and there, right? Now, of course, you can't interpret the Bible as simplistically because there are other parts of it, as in where Jesus of Nazareth is said to have stated to his followers and to the people who are questioning him, you must give to Caesar what is Caesar's, meaning taxes and all that, but everything else goes to the Lord, right? So you can't neglect worldly, you can't neglect religion for worldly business, right? You've got to take care of some things. You've got to do what society is asking you to do, if it's fair and just, of course, the Bible says. But when it comes down to being a Christian or going through the motions in the world first, you need to be Christian. And so when it comes to being Christian or being involved in politics, it sort of sounds like an interpretation of this could be taken as leave the politics at the door and follow me. And of course, this is something that the church has tried to promote over the years, even when it was basically in charge of all political affairs in Europe, that politics need to be left at the door, that people all around the world deserve the mercy and love of Jesus because he came for everybody, right? This is what the church teaches its followers, and that politics should not get in the way. Of course, I believe anybody who's an observer of history knows that politics does get in the way in the Catholic Church. It is a human institution, after all, chasing a divine. But even in the Great Awakening, to have this idea of religion, to have this idea of politics somewhat intertwined is fascinating. And for this to have happened nearly 300 years ago shows us here in the present day exactly how easy it is for a religion to permeate into politics. And because it's permeated for so long, we end up seeing especially Christianity be the one to rear its head in the 60s and 70s in our Cold War era as the dominant religion trying to take over American politics. And so the First Great Awakening ends, the American Revolution happens, the Declaration of Independence is written, the founders come up with a document that is supposed to promote religious freedom, and among many other freedoms, of course, and the Treaty of Tripoli happens with the clause in Article 11 that states that America was never intended or founded to be a Christian nation. But of course, Christianity does make a comeback, if you can call it a comeback. Because Christianity never actually left. And of course, if we call something a first Great Awakening, that means that logically a second Great Awakening follows. Now, this Great Awakening takes place more throughout the entire country. By this time, as a nation, we've already expanded throughout the Louisiana Territory. We have the idea of Manifest Destiny coming very soon, and we're growing as a nation. But of course, there is still one gigantic issue facing our country, and that is the issue of slavery. We had the Missouri Compromise. You'll end up seeing Compromise of 1850, the Dred Scott decision, all these things that lead to the Civil War. Well, we're avoiding the Civil War in this topic because it really doesn't have much to do with Christian nationalism, but the Second Great Awakening does. So the Second Great Awakening, taking place roughly 100 years, only a couple of generations after the First Great Awakening, starts to see a more political shift in Christianity in America. And this political shift, of course, involves the elephant in the room I just mentioned, which is slavery. So two of the preachers at this time, of different Christian faiths, of course, Henry Ward Beecher and James Ryder, who's actually a Jesuit, give plenty of sermons during this time promoting the idea of either abolition or being in favor of enslavement. And what's interesting to note about who's on what side, Henry Ward Beecher, of course, is the father of Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Being from New England themselves, they are very much so abolitionists. It is actually the Jesuit priest, James Ryder, who is focusing on pro-slavery arguments. While this might come as a surprise to many of you listening out there, the Jesuits were definitely in favor of slavery. And even as a matter of fact, a primary source document was found which showed a transaction of enslaved people which practically saved Georgetown University, which is a Jesuit university, in Washington, D.C. in the 1800s. And so the Jesuits have been dealing with their own history of slavery and enslavement of Africans and, of course, Black Americans born here in this country. So to hear a Jesuit favoring slavery, while it sounds shocking at its face, is not when you look at the facts. You can even go so far as to look at the Catholic Church in New York City during the Civil War with the New York City draft riots, where the Archbishop at the time in New York argued not quite in favor of slavery, but the Catholic Church's line that, well, slavery's already there and we don't want to be political about this, so we're going to leave it be for now. We really shouldn't have a war over it because war is bad. Just to sort of very quickly summarize the church's thoughts on American enslavement at this time. And of course, this is the era when many European nations are outlawing or have already outlawed the enslavement of human beings. In America, it took us a little longer to do that, and of course cost us at least 600,000 lives in the name of doing that with our Civil War. So again, in this Second Great Awakening, people are sort of gearing up for war in a way, more a war over souls and what we should be doing with the soul of our nation. And so these sermons are a little longer. Beecher gave a sermon, obviously, with a more, how do you want to put it, a more abolitionist tone. And Ryder decides to give the Jesuit perspective for promoting slavery. Let's actually start with Ryder, who discusses pro-slavery forces. He said in a meeting of Jesuits, so sort of a sermon to, you know, playing to the crowd a little bit, you know, singing to the choir, if you will. If then the Catholic in the North, despite such powerful provocation, has baffled the malignity of designing fanatics who, under the cloak of religious zeal, brandished the torch of persecution, how can the Catholics of the South be other than faithful in defending the rights and property of that chivalrous people, always distinguished for their love of liberty and their high-minded liberality, amongst whom he enjoys all the blessings of our happy Constitution? He has too long been the victim of persecution not to feel an intense interest in the preservation of that order of things under which he enjoys religious and civil liberty. The Catholic feels his obligations to his country and is willing to prove his gratitude whenever an occasion occurs. He knows that love of country is a sacred and holy passion, which reason and religion approve, that his altars and his country's rights are identified, and that he cannot be faithful to his God if deficient in fidelity to his country, which embraces all the charities of all. He is convinced, too, that the day which shall witness the overthrow of our glorious system of national independence will date the persecution of Catholicity. It is for this reason that he hates bigotry in every shape and color. Could my feeble voice reach these misguided abettors of disorder? I would ask them, what possible advantage can they anticipate from the spread of their favorite system of abolition? Can they hope to better the condition of the slave? Let them look to the disgusting state of morals among the colored free in the northern cities, where they are, for the greater part, a nuisance to the white population in almost every department of life. And then let them look to the peaceful and contented and secure condition of the southern slave, under the gentle sway of an upright master. Here the slave has a home. He is clothed, maintained, and protected by his master, who looks upon him as a portion of his family. In sickness, he is attended with medical aid, and frequently solaced by the material kindness of his compassionate mistress. I'm sorry, I didn't realize whipping, beating, separating families, selling people off at a whim, and generally treating them like horrible property was loving and caring. But of course, that's me looking back on this from our perspective right now. Many people shared that perspective, especially in the North, the abolitionists, at the time that Ryder gave this presentation. And of course, this was in August of 1835. So we are still 30 years away from the official end of enslavement of Africans or anybody, or Black Americans or anybody in our country with the 13th Amendment. But Ryder brings up many points that a lot of Southerners used to justify enslavement. We are bringing them to a better condition. We have given them purpose, a sense of self-worth, something they never had on their home continent in Africa. We're making them better people. They are rising to the occasion. They're becoming exactly what God wants them to become. A part of our society, people who will never be equal to us, but who are going to be valuable members in the way that we need them to be. This is a line for line what any slave owner would say. This is line for line what any politician in the South would say. It sounds like something that John C. Calhoun could come up with in a speech to continue to support something. It sounds like Jefferson Davis's inaugural address could have included things like this if they weren't so worried about trying to mask some states' rights through their speeches. Although, of course, when you look at those documents, there was no masking what they wanted to do. The first sentence usually included keeping Africans and Black Americans in slavery. But Ryder, interestingly, as a Jesuit, understands that getting involved in politics for a Catholic probably is not the best thing, considering that people didn't really like Catholics at the time. And so by looking through this in a practical lens, he tries to continue to set back an entire race of people, an entire group of people, based on the color of their skin and condition of their servitude. It's quite interesting to note what was said there, because you tend to hear it, as I said, from the politicians, from other sort of preachers at the time. But yes, religion is one of the things that was used to justify enslavement and slavery throughout American history. Beecher, to his credit, gives a little bit of a different perspective and talks about sort of the opposite side of being a god of everybody and not really injecting himself into politics. In one of Beecher's more famous speeches, homilies, if you will, he sort of gives this perspective. And what he has said stood the test of time to be analyzed by people like us here. So let's take a look at what Beecher had to say in his homily, not in direct response, not a sermon in direct response, but his perspective of it as well. If God is the God of the whole earth, he must be the God of the whole earth just as it is. And I remark that while believers in the true God were tribal and national, the natural mistake which was made, and which should put us on our guard lest we fall into it again in substance, was that of supposing that God was in a special manner the God of a particular class. So let us not forget that if he is the God of the whole earth, he is the God of all those physical conditions under which men are born. He is the God of those laws of descent which make the character of the parent go down to the children through many generations. He is the God of those decrees by which the drunkard's children inherit the drunkard's proclivities, by which deceit propagates deceit, by which honor breeds honor, by which motives brought to bear upon parents have an effect on the welfare of their children reaching down to the depths of futurity. He is the God of the climate in which every person lives, of that climate which drives the Eskimo underground during the most months of the year, and that climate which brings the swarthy African all of the year into the open air, without clothes and without a swelling. If he is the God of all the earth, then he is the God that establishes those laws which determine the occupations of men and their characters in a large degree. He is the God of the physical globe in this sense, that whatever affects men by its nature, by its unconscious and continuous influence upon them, is of his ordination. Being the God of the whole earth, he is the God of the mountains and of the valleys, of the winter and of the summer, of industry and of commerce, of all the arrangements of life by which men are influenced. Men's places of abode and their nature are largely determined by their circumstances, and these circumstances are God's decrees. Now, while you hear this and might think that Beecher is almost agreeing, he says that if God's the God of the whole earth, he must be the God of the whole earth just as it is, right? And he talks about tribalism and nationalism a little bit there as well, but not in a way where religion should be controlling any sort of politics or that there's any sort of predestination for people, right? He's the God of the people and the condition they're in, yes, but that isn't what defines them necessarily, right? You can look at this and say, well, just because a person's parent is a drunkard, it does not mean they will be a drunkard. Just because a person is honorable does not mean that their parents were honorable or that their children will be honorable, right? There are other circumstances. And so I think what Beecher's main point here is, you know, if God is the God of the whole earth and he's God of the earth the way it is, then nothing's going to change. Nothing would change because that's it. What is, what will be never will be, because what is always will be. I know it's a very philosophical way to look at it, but this is what Beecher is saying, right? Yes, the Eskimo always goes. And of course, that is the word that would have been used at the time. Of course, we're talking about, you know, the Inuit people, natives, First Nations in Canada, if you will, indigenous who live in the Arctic in that area, would not necessarily be buried underground, but they would be trying to keep warm for many parts of the year, right? Near the equator in Africa, yes, it is quite hot, so people are going to create shelters, right? The nature doesn't change, but the circumstances and who people are, that can definitely change. And so Beecher's point is like, you know, if God is just the God of the whole earth, then it's just as is, right? But there are circumstances where people can change. Beecher argues for abolition. This is not a condition that God created. It's a condition that man created, right? So in a way, what man is doing is against where God wanted people to be. And so you can see how by injecting themselves into the argument of slavery, enslavement of people, the Second Great Awakening becomes much more political than the First Great Awakening. And of course, after these great awakenings, there seems to be in American history, especially in the usual curriculum taught to students, sort of ignoring a little bit of the religion until we get through parts of the, you know, late 19th, early 20th century. But we tend to move more towards political movements in that way. However, as we're going to see in the next part of this episode, these are not the only preachers that would gain hold in American political life. While it takes almost 100 years for this to happen again, just notice that it was about 100 years between the First and Second Great Awakening. And while there have been other time periods claimed as Great Awakenings throughout history, it takes a good 100 to 120 years for Christian nationalism to start rising. So it does seem that every century, just like, you know, pandemics or even the use of tariffs and economic policy, about every 100 years is a good time to find something new. And so as we fast forward for the second half of this episode, about 100 years into the future, we're going to see two other preachers who really took hold in Americans' lives, who affected Americans' lives greatly, and also put themselves in the political spectrum for years to come. And now we jump back into our time machine and go back toward the future, I suppose. And we get to the 1970s and 1980s in American history. And this is where we're going to start looking at two of the most influential pastors in American history, especially late 20th century, early American history, Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell. And instead of doing a large introduction for now, let's let Billy Graham speak for himself and then put some context into what he said and give you an idea of who went to a Billy Graham event, what they were looking for, and how he started to influence American politics.
If you try to tell how great you are and leave God out, or if you act as though you can solve your own problems and arrange your own life without the help of God, God says, I'm going to bring you down. We've gotten so used to ease and luxury and fine foods and being rich Americans that when you go to India and go to Africa and go to other parts of the world and realize that we're only 6% of the population of the world, but we own so much of the wealth of the world. We're wealthy, we're rich, and when you read about a rich man in the Bible, in comparison to the people Jesus was talking about, it's talking about nearly all Americans. Even the people we call poor in America are considered rich in Bangladesh, rich in India. You talk about poverty in some parts of the world, and you have to really explain what you mean. Because they don't understand American poverty, because American poverty is wealth compared to great hordes of the people of the world.
Well, thank you for that, Pastor Graham. Let's try to unpack what you were saying there. So for any listeners wondering, this is from the Handwriting on the Wall speech, sermon, if you will, from St. Louis, Missouri in 1973. He packed a large arena, almost a football stadium size arena in St. Louis. And his goal, obviously, is to evangelize, to give people what they need in terms of spiritual blessings or thoughts, or to contemplate their own lives in America. And quite interestingly, you get two themes throughout, right? You get this idea of, the second one first is quite interesting. The poor in America are still rich. They've gotten too used to eating fine foods. They've gotten too used to certain luxuries. In a way, Graham starts to categorize the poor in America as entitled, which is quite interesting. It really goes back to Goldwater talking about the nanny and the welfare state and all the entitlements that people get. And he compares poverty in America to poverty in other countries. He talks about India, talks about Bangladesh. He's talking about South Asia. In other parts of the sermon, he brings up different parts of Africa and the world where people, he says, are, quote, truly poor, right? So the idea that American poverty isn't really poverty begins to discount millions of people who depend on the government, who depend on maybe welfare, who depend on unemployment or Medicare, Medicaid. Basically, all the recipients of the Great Society and of New Deal programs are
not really that poor. They have so much in America. When they cry poor, what they're really crying is, I don't have all the luxuries. I only have some, or I got used to certain things. Now I can't get them and I want them back. It almost makes Americans out to be whiny crybabies who need everything handed to them. And while it's true that poverty in America might be different than poverty in other countries, some of the people who are poor in America, especially in the 70s and even today, are way worse off than people in other countries because some of those welfare and nanny state programs, as conservatives would call them, or, you know, basic human rights, as others may say, are given to people in those countries, are given to people in those areas. You can get some sort of health care, you can get some sort of basic universal needs met while still being poor. In America, that is much tougher. So for Graham to make that comparison and say that, you know, Jesus and God's wrath will come for you because you are, quote, poor in America, when you really are some of the wealthiest people in the world, you know, shame on you. Shame on you for calling yourself poor. These are the real poor in the world. It's sort of insulting and degrading to a group of people who are poor, yes, by a different standard, but in some cases just as worse off or even worse off than people around the world in the nations that Graham describes. So really unpacking that is very interesting. But it goes to his point that America is a rich nation and that this rich nation needs to be careful or it will be smited by God, especially by wanting more. So by living in a rich nation while still claiming to be poor, you're wanting more, you're wanting too much, and you're not helping out the poor in other areas. And Graham sort of makes this message very clear. I'm not sure the audience that he's speaking to understood that or saw that. It's a nicer, more paternalistic way of inserting fear into people, into the people's lives or their subconsciouses, or using the fearful part of religion, as Great Awakening pastors would have, to sort of control people or put them on a path towards voting and praying a certain way, and more merging of Christianity with trying to save their own souls and be doing well on their own, without necessarily considering all the needs of others, by demonizing the other, by categorizing people as faking it, you know, to get more out of the government. It's really quite an interesting take from somebody who's claiming to be Christian and is clearly political when bringing in wealth and poverty and or lack thereof with wealth into the discussion. And in the first part, that first clip that I played for you, he's talking about world leaders needing to give glory to God. You know, God gave you that power. You know, God is the true power in our world, in our universe, in all of creation. And yes, this is an accepted Christian theme. It's also a quite dangerous Christian theme that ran completely through the Middle Ages and allowed the Catholic Church to dominate earthly power by crowning and supporting and sometimes excommunicating different leaders of nations based on how much fealty they showed to the Pope in Rome, even the papacy itself being split between Rome and Avignon, France, during the Middle Ages, is quite the interesting story that shows how the Church's involvement in earthly power may not have been the best for the spirituality of its flock. Graham is sort of disregarding this when he says that these nations, these leaders, don't give fealty, they don't give praise and glory to God for everything. They take credit for things on their own. They don't show the humility toward God. And yes, this would be a perfectly acceptable message for a Christian. But again, especially in America, not everybody is Christian. And so by saying this is necessary for all world leaders, but especially leaders in America, it's alienating people. It's once again fusing Christianity and American political theater, American political goals for conservatives. It's merging together the idea of Christianity and nationalism in a way that would, as we saw in the last episode, argued against, that this is not something that should be promoted by Christians, that the Jesus of Nazareth from the Bible would not be supportive of this, considering he even said himself that his kingdom was out of this world. And so Graham quite interestingly captures these people's hearts and minds. He captures their souls. He gets to them with this talk of, you may feel like you are poor, but you're not. Or you are wealthier than you think you are. You need to start acting more humble. You need to start acting as though you're going to help the poor. You need to remind yourself that when you think things aren't going your way, someone else has it worse off. Again, not a contemptible philosophy to live your life by, but definitely something that is not quite universal in the way of political theory. It's more religiosity than it is political theory. And again, it flies in the face of everything we've seen from the founders up until this point, but it also starts to compound on Hoover, Goldwater, some of Reagan, who at this time is beginning to think about running for the presidency, considering how successful he's been as governor of California, and we'll start to see that in a couple of minutes. But even after Graham, you had more influential pastors, and Graham's influence lasted for a long time. Graham lived into the 21st century, but his influence may have even been overshadowed by one more megachurch pastor, and that would be the man that we heard from in the beginning of this episode, the Reverend Jerry Falwell. Now, Falwell also begins his mission, I suppose he could call it a mission, or more likely his time in American politics, quite around the same time as Graham. He is a member of the evangelical Christian community who initially, well, the evangelicals at least, I'm not totally sure about Falwell, supported Jimmy Carter during his campaign in 1976 against Gerald Ford. Carter is somebody who, being from Georgia, shared his own sort of born-again story, his own evangelical Christian life, and promoted how his faith really helped to save him, grounded him. A lot of us know the story of Jimmy Carter already, especially through his long-term marriage to Rosalynn, his wife, who supported him by his side. You're talking about, you know, the son of farmers, a peanut farmer from Georgia, who rose to become the governor of the state and then eventually president of the United States in a little bit of a, well, no pun intended, left turn from the chaos of Nixon and Ford after that. And so Carter's election is seen as a win for some evangelicals. I mean, they did vote for him because of his story. But that actually goes against what you would consider to be the core evangelical support of American politics at the time. Carter's election with some evangelical support actually flies in the face of some studies done about who would support Billy Graham. Who are the converted? Who are the Billy Graham people, right? And so in a study done right around these elections, right around 1970, right? So in the beginning of this time, late spring in Knoxville, Tennessee, a few sociologists did a study. They did some surveys of about just over 10% of the people who would attend his crusades throughout Knoxville, Tennessee. And this was one of about 10 events that happened. They sat down with the crowd. They tried to look at the demographics. They tried to interview as many people as they could. And they made an interesting note about the crowd size. There were quite a few women in the crowd. Women were not ignored by Billy Graham, by evangelicals. Women have always been very important in any sort of political action, but especially with conservatives. You know, we're looking at 1970 here, 1973. You had the landmark decision of Roe v. Wade. You had the Equal Rights Amendment. A lot of women rallied against that cause. They were sort of similar to this ilk here. They are evangelicals. They are conservatives. They don't see the idea of women's rights being something positive because it's harming the family, harming their structure. Interesting note by the authors of this study, though, that it's been said that early Christianity was a religion of slaves and women. So it's quite interesting to consider that, looking at the history of Christianity, when it comes to defending enslavement is quite ironic in that sense, considering that a lot of the people who were enslaved would have followed Christ during his time, you know, this Jesus of Nazareth, and that women such as his own mother Mary and of course Mary Magdalene and other famous women that we read from the Bible all the time, as if you are a Christian reading from your Bible all the time, that women and the enslaved, you know, the people who were stuck in sort of lesser place in society, flocks to Christianity first. So of course, just gotta note that irony as well, that, you know, women and slaves would have been the people that were the target audience for Christianity to believe in something bigger and better than what they were subjected to in their lives on earth. Well, slavery officially abolished by the 13th Amendment, I suppose descendants of the enslaved are not very well represented here, but women are. Quite a few women, actually. It was a 2-to-1 ratio, sometimes between 5 and 8 to 1, reported in different areas. So quite a few women latching onto the message of Billy Graham. It's again, very interesting to note, considering the voting patterns of women throughout American history. Now, why do I bring up this study now, talking about Carter and Falwell? Because it really does relate to the electoral process. It relates to who evangelicals are going to vote for, and it shows why evangelical support for Carter was a bit of an outlier, and perhaps people should have seen the rise of a Falwell coming along with people like Billy Graham. It turns out that at this study in Tennessee, they tried to figure out who these people voted for by asking them. And it turns out that an overwhelming 71% of attendees supported Richard Nixon in the 1968 election over Hubert Humphrey by a margin of 5-to-1. And that is an astonishing number. It definitely shows how people resonated with Nixon's messaging on, well, like I said in the first episode, the chaos that was 1968, the absolute rioting in the streets, you know, rioting outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, all the assassinations that took place in that year and around that time. And of course, Nixon's eventual plea to the silent majority about taking back our country, you know, taking back our nation, our streets, ending all this violence, going back to a sense of normalcy, you know, people that don't normally speak up, the ones who are silent in their homes. They don't want this. They don't want these protests about the Vietnam War. They don't want any of this. They want life to be quiet again. These seem to be the kind of people who are going to Billy Graham rallies. And as a matter of fact, when you look at their political leanings as well, yes, many people would identify as either moderate, conservative, or even uncertain. Less than 10% of the people who went to a Billy Graham rally or event, if you will, were considered to be liberal. So Graham is clearly preaching to the choir here, quite literally. And so these people, to have some sort of a connection with Carter, shows that they were willing to back a different candidate, or it shows they were just so incredibly disappointed with Gerald Ford that they had to vote for somebody else. And they found a reason to do that because of Carter's evangelical backgrounds. Fast forward to Carter's presidency, however, and we can see that the support for him is waning. As a matter of fact, according to the historian Seth Dowland, when you look at an article he wrote called Family Values and the Formation of a Christian Right Agenda, he even mentions how Carter was trying to placate evangelicals, but he failed. The problem was there was a huge group of evangelicals that Carter would try to organize and assemble, but they did not feel that he was living up to his end of the bargain, especially because he was distancing himself from people like Falwell, especially as he got closer to the 1980 campaign. A lot of what Falwell would say would be taken as incendiary, Even though he may have claimed to not mean the things that he said, he would often rally against liberal causes and even the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, who were big-time supporters of Carter and of the usually the Democratic Party liberal agenda, even though you could argue that may have changed a little bit over the past few months in American politics. But comments that Falwell would make, such as claiming that America wasn't a Christian nation, but is very Christian, possibly equating him with people who were anti-Semitic. Carter would try to distance himself from Falwell. He's not of the faith, that of the Jerry Falwells of the world, he went on to say, and that they were linking Falwell with Reagan quite early on in the campaign. While this didn't exactly work out for Carter, it definitely worked out for Reagan, who, as we see, gets elected in 1980 thanks to the support of this Falwell moral majority. And so we can see how the bridge from Graham to Falwell is sort of held up by a keystone of Jimmy Carter, but also just a more, if you will, hardening of the bloc. A more resolute conservative base is now forming around a political organization called the Moral Majority. And this Moral Majority would go on to help one man reach the White House for the next 8 years. And that man was Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was actually asked if he would continue to listen to the voices of the people who elected him in a press conference. Let's hear from Reagan as he took a question upon his inauguration.
As you go about forming your new government and selecting the people who are going to head the cabinet, be in your cabinet, and run the government, how much consideration are you going to give to the advice of these new conservative organizations and the Moral Majority and people like the Reverend Jerry Falwell?
I am going to be open to these people. You are president of all the people, and I am going to want to seek advice where I think that I can get advice from those who are familiar with a particular problem. I'm not going to separate myself from the people who elected us and sent us there.
And Reagan definitely held true to that. He credited the Moral Majority with his election wins, and even went as far as to start speaking at events like the Conservative Political Action Committee, CPAC, events, and continued to promote similar values as he did as the governor of California, and tried to make America incredibly conservative and almost bend it to his will in a way that possibly a strongman would, as we heard the idea from Catherine Stewart in the last episode. So Reagan embodies the sort of leader people need. There's been chaos for much of the last 5 to 10 years of American history, and throughout the 1970s and the late 1960s, it got to be too much for people. So now Reagan comes into office and completely credits Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell, and people like that for his election. And yet, Falwell's Moral Majority probably was not even a majority. It was a small minority of people who helped to elect Reagan. And as we see in the December 1987 edition of Social Science Quarterly, a study was done to find out just how many people supported this Moral Majority. And the study showed that in both 1980 or 1984, there is no evidence that the Moral Majority appealed to the average citizen. And that, a matter of fact, the chances of an average citizen supporting the Moral Majority were only about 1 in 12. So who is this Moral Majority then? Well, they seemed to be people who were evangelical in nature, like a born-again experience. They seemed to be incredibly religious, attending church every week and praying quite often and getting guidance from religion on a day-to-day basis. The most conservative views possible to express on defense spending, abortion, women's liberation, school prayer, and probably most importantly, a strong Republican Party identification, gave a strong probability of support for the Moral Majority. So these are your hard right Republicans who are professing morality as their main cause for electing a president. And there's nothing inherently wrong with morality being a North Star for you, but for the moral majority to claim that tens of thousands, if not millions of people in each state were supporting them is incredibly disingenuous. And for Reagan to credit such a small number of people for electing him to office does seem on its face very disingenuous to many of the people who voted for him for a lot of different reasons. As a matter of fact, in the conclusion of the study, popular support was limited both in 1984 and in 1980. It did not diminish, though, meaning the support was exactly the same. So the moral majority may not have been a majority of conservatives or Republicans, but the number of people that subscribed to the moral majority and the number of people who voted for Reagan as a part of this moral majority stayed the same. So he counted on consistent support, but it wasn't this support that drove the campaign. It may have tipped the edge in some way, but it definitely helped to have these people in his camp. And perhaps Reagan saw that as a sign that he needed to appeal to them more often. And so the moral majority and Jerry Falwell are brought into the forefront by Reagan and his campaign to rally against liberal causes, to rally against groups like the ACLU, especially in speeches televised to the nation and in press conferences to the nation, a lot of times supported by a Republican arm of the political establishment.
I was asked by a very talented reporter in another state 2 weeks ago, a reporter who happened to be Jewish, what do you Christians have against the ACLU? I said, well, you need to understand that we Christians, Bible-believing Christians, think of the ACLU in the same way that you Jews think of the Nazis. Something to be avoided. Somebody who's out to get us.
Now, this is definitely Falwell's wheelhouse here. He sees the American Civil Liberties Union as something that's defending immorality in American culture, and he wants it to pretty much not even just stay in its lane, but disappear. Christians should be afraid of the ACLU because it promotes such an anti-Christian view of America and the world that it cannot be sustained and should not be supported. This is common throughout Falwell's time in American political theater, and we're going to see and hear more from Falwell in the next episode about the ACLU when we talk about the early 21st century coming out of 9/11. And so, as the Republican Party moves on through the 80s, Reagan continues to hold on to the strength of his party. As a matter of fact, his hold on the party is so strong that his vice president, George H.W. Bush, that would be Bush 41, is elected as pretty much a third term of Reagan. Bush's sole term in office is marred by his, read my lips, no new taxes, and then all of a sudden, hey, new taxes. And we can look back now and see how that hurt Bush in the election. However, in 1992, he did face a primary challenge from somebody who's been around Reagan, who's been around conservative politics for a while, and that was Pat Buchanan. And Pat Buchanan eventually lost the nomination to George H.W. Bush in 1992, who went on to lose to Bill Clinton. And I think it's fitting to close out with Buchanan because Buchanan can bridge us to the next episode. Buchanan can bridge us into the latest of the 20th century, the 1990s, and the early 21st century when it comes to Christian nationalism. If you had Reagan referring to a city on a hill, if you had Falwell and Graham espousing Christianity over everything else, then you have Pat Buchanan looking at the chaos of American history and referring to what many people see now as the catch-all term for turmoil in America. The culture wars.
Friends, this election is about more than who gets what. It is about who we are. It is about what we believe and what we stand for as Americans. There is a religious war going on in this country. It is a cultural war as critical to the kind of nation we shall be as the Cold War itself, for this war is for the soul of America. And in that struggle for the soul of America, Clinton and Clinton are on the other side, and George Bush is on our side.
And of course, this is the perfect lead-in to our last episode. We will be focusing mostly on the early 21st century, but of course we'll touch a little bit on the Bill Clinton presidency as well, and why the Christian nationalists were not big fans of him. And then toward the end of the episode, we'll jump a little bit into the current climate, but not too much since we are trying to analyze history here. But we'll wrap it up with a little bit of a discussion about Christian nationalism, how it's developed, and go over pretty much everything we saw in these last couple of episodes and tie it all together in a nice, lovely contextualized bow so that when you have a dinner party or conversation with people, you can be on top of current events, because that's what we're trying to do here. Make sure that you can look at the past to try to change the future with what we do here in the present. So once again, thank you very much for joining me. I am Pete Stamm, aka That History Teacher. YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, go check it out. And of course, this has been another episode of That History Podcast. Stay tuned for episode 3 in our Christian Nationalism series coming up very soon.